From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Tony Hendra revels in humor that shocks, upsets, and offends. Hendra spent 8 years as editor of the National Lampoon, and he's written a history of irreverent humor called Going Too Far. On today's Fresh Air, Hendra answers the complaint he's heard a million times, "That's not funny, that's sick." Also today, writer Andrew Halloran talks about his new collection of essays, Ground Zero. They chronicle gay life in the time of AIDS. And we have reviews of a reissue of Duke Ellington's Far East Suite and of the new made-for-TV movie, Gotham. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. The rise and demise of sick, gross, black, sophomoric, weird, pinko, anarchic, underground, anti-establishment humor is the subject of Tony Hendra's new book, Going Too Far. It surveys the generation of baby boom humorists, starting with their predecessors like Lenny Bruce and Mort Saul in the 50s, and continuing with 60s comics like Smothers Brothers and Richard Pryor, and the 1970s humor of the National Lampoon and Saturday Night Live. Tony Hendra is himself one of the comic voices to emerge from the baby boom. He first came to America from England to tour his club act. He stayed and went on to edit the humor magazine The National Lampoon and to direct their Woodstock spoof, Lemmings. Hendra later edited and co-wrote several satirical books, including Not the New York Times and Off the Wall Street Journal. In the heavy metal movie parody, This is Spinal Tap, he played the role of the band's manager. I spoke to Tony Hendra from the NPR Bureau in New York. I told him I was surprised that he wrote his new book, which surveys and analyzes humor, because humorists frequently resist being analyzed.
Yes, well, it's a fairly dangerous occupation, writing about humor. I tried to avoid the sort of basic problem that most people seem to get into, which is the sort of Germanic approach, you know. The joke goes in the ear and it activates the lumbar muscle, you know, and then the contractions, and then laughter is the result. You know, those kind of Freudian kind of explanations.
Right. But
I did, actually, the book started as a sort of history of the National Lampoon, which I was used to be editor of for a while, back in the days when it was good, and it became clear to me, you know, that the sort of roots and origins of the kind of stuff that we did when we were cooking there really went much further back than I had realized.
You use the phrase boomer humor to describe the kind of humor that the Lampoon was part of. Yeah, why don't you describe what you mean?
Well, it's an unfortunate term, but and so is rock and
roll.
You
made it up, right?
Right. So is rock and roll, you know. It's self-explanatory to the extent that it's a humor, I think, is sort of peculiar to what we call the baby boom generation, whatever that is. I actually do think that perhaps the comparison to rock and roll is not without merit, in the sense that I think our generation has as distinctive a kind of humor as our music is, and that's why I set out to try and put it all in one place.
One of the distinctions you give to this kind of humor is that it frequently goes too far, or that people think it would, and that it tackles previously off-limits subjects. And I wonder what you're comparing it to. You're comparing this to, say, Bob Hope, whose humor seems very tame by comparison?
Well, it's, there's two issues here. One is that this is not the only kind of humor. You know, I'm not suggesting that there's no other kind that makes people laugh or should. You know, there's easy listening and there's rock and roll and there's heavy metal. I mean, this is a certain kind of humor. Other kinds of humor continue parallel. But I think the most, from a historical point of view, the most interesting thing is that what preceded this was a very different and gentler and more trivial kind of humor that found its expression with people like extremely funny people, I should add, like Buddy Hackett and Milton Berle and Jackie Leonard, that whole tradition of sort of grand old ethnic comedians who really stayed in very safe areas of the park. And what made Mort Saul and Lenny Bruce and Second City critically different was that on the one hand, they were quite determinedly intelligent. I mean, they were smart comedians in a world where basically the sillier and more stupid you were, the funnier you were. They also dealt with issues which previously had been completely off limits. The Cold War, sexism, racism, all kinds of issues which comedians wouldn't touch with a barge pole before that.
Well, for a while you edited mm-hmm. National Lampoon, mm-hmm. and you wrote for them. Now, you were something of an outsider in the sense that you were British, so there... here's what I think. That there were probably a lot of, like, American in-jokes and jokes about Howdy Doody and TV shows and things like that that, uh-huh. that you maybe weren't that keyed into having come from England. I don't know. Were you from a slightly different...
I think I better shoot myself.
Oh, yeah. Is this what the question made you think about?
Actually, I think yes, obviously, a great deal of... I have been in this country for a quarter of a century, and I'm beginning to understand, that you say can't, not can't, stuff like that. But no, it took me a long time to understand the nuance of, if you like, to learn American in both the language sense and the cultural sense. But
what I'm thinking is that so much of... the Lampoon and a lot of humor is based on little shared experiences mm-hmm. and TV shows, radio shows, bubblegum cards, things like that, that you wonder, how much of it would relate, overseas.
Well, it's, as I say, first of all, I've spent almost all my professional career here.
Yeah.
And I was one of the original editors of the Lampoon, so I mean, however, I suppose I got away with it somehow. It does seem to me, though, that there is something else special about this kind of humor, which actually I hadn't thought about before. There was a very parallel and similar phenomenon in England, which began in the mid-50s, as this kind of humor did in America, with people like Peter Sellers and The Goon Show and Peter Cook and Dudley Moore and Beyond the Fringe, and That Was the Week That Was. A very similar kind of humor that... took on very similar kind of targets. I mean, I think one of the things that distinguishes this kind of humor is that it was not based in the trivial. It was not based in, the recognition of, an old-time television commercial. It was about the Pentagon. It was about, mm-hmm. It was about the church. It was about religious and sexual hypocrisy. It was, in a sense, those are universal subjects. I don't think it matters what language you speak.
You describe the Lampoon as having turned on the last thing that was sacred, which was that generation itself, the generation writing the Lampoon.
Uh-huh. Well, I think that's that was one of... I think, actually, that's always been the saving grace of boomer humorists. I mean, that they were able to be as funny about themselves as they were about the people that they were attacking. Jules Pfeiffer is a prime example of that. I mean, his stuff right from the start was as much about people who you would assume were on his side as it was about, the half-wits in charge. And I think we not only carried on the tradition in its more obvious ways, like, attacking the government and organized religion and so off, but we also identified the new generation of half-wits, the managers of Woodstock Nation, who were just as full of it as the last lot. And that was one of our unique things, I think, at the Lampoon.
Sure, you did a whole parody of Woodstock called the Woodshuck Festival.
Sure, Lemmings.
Yeah, event, yeah.
Which, that was an off-Broadway hit in 1973. That actually had Belushi and Chevy Chase and Christopher Guest. Pretty impressive bunch of people.
Did you offend any people with it?
I remember... It was a series of the whole second act was a parody of Woodstock, and it had a series of parodies of singers, not all of whom were at Woodstock, some of those singers actually came to see the show. I remember one night James Taylor and Carly Simon came, and it was an extremely savage James Taylor parody in the show, and he didn't laugh at all. Carly, however, fell on the floor.
and remember, they got divorced later on.
Yes. This, I probably caused that.
Did you write that parody?
No, actually, Sean Kelly wrote that.
Now, you did write a John Lennon parody on...
Well, actually, right? Yes, that was on an early National Lampoon album called Radio Dinner. As a matter of fact, John Lennon wrote that parody. All the words in that song are from the Primal Therapy interviews, Primal Scream interviews he gave to Rolling Stone. So every single word in that song is actually was actually from the very gut of John Lennon.
Do you remember any of it? Could you recite some of it for us?
No, I really couldn't. Not even on National Public Radio.
Oh, right. Okay.
You perhaps don't remember quite how demotic it was.
Right. Now, did Lennon ever hear it?
Yes, apparently some idiot in KRLA played it to him and Yoko, and he was described as emerging ashen-faced after hearing it.
Now, I don't know if he was important to you musically, but how did it make you feel knowing that he was really offended by it?
Well, I didn't know that for sure. I mean, I certainly don't think... It was a strange experience. I mean, I don't think you can really do satire, and certainly not parody, unless you, in a funny kind of way, love your target, you know? It did seem to me that what those interviews were indicating was a sort of egomania, you know, a kind of self-obsession that Lennon was getting into at that time, which was very disappointing because he really was a hero of mine. So, I mean, I don't really care if he was offended. I think the song actually had a point to make. But it was only worth making because I cared about him.
Another parody that you wrote was Deteriorata, based on Desiderata.
Uh-huh.
Could you recall for us what Desiderata was, and maybe you can recite a verse of Deteriorata?
Gosh, I can't remember it. Desiderata was this awful, soupy, sentimental thing. Go placidly amid the noise and waste, was it?
Yes.
It was just... Sorry?
Oh, well, posters of it were hung on countless dormitories.
Oh,
walls.
Yes. No, it was as popular as the Velvet Jesus. It was all over the place. And it was this dreadful sort of reader's... It was supposed to have been discovered in an old Pennsylvania church, I think, or something like that. And it had this sort of phony 18th-century diction.
And it was kind of Hallmark inspirational.
Yeah, yeah. But definitely came from sort of Reader's Digest. And so, anyway, we wrote a parody of it. I wrote a parody of it, which was called Deteriorata. And I really, honestly can't remember any of Deteriorata, except...
The part I remember is that you are a fluke of the universe. You have no right to be here.
Hey. Yes, pretty good. Let not the sands of time get in your lunch. Hire people with hooks.
That's right.
Yes, coming back
really
to me
like
now.
That.
Yeah. Anyway, that became a not nearly so large-selling poster, but we did sell a few of them.
Now, on one of your records, you write in your new book, Going Too Far, that RCA refused to release it unless you deleted the satires of relating to President Nixon and to Julian David Eisenhower. How did that wind up?
Well, that was the same album on which the Lennon parody appeared, and a number of other things, including an extremely nasty parody of Joan Baez. I must say, there were these very harmless things about David and Julie in bed, you know, with David saying things like, "Don't worry, honey, I took the pills," you know, that kind of stuff. I mean, real tame stuff. And what I was really worried about was that the record industry would just go nuts when they heard this sort of Lennon knock and Baez knock, and there was a Dylan parody on it too. But they didn't care a bit. What they cared about was the fact that they just sold... something like a quarter of $1 billion worth of defense contracts to the Nixon administration. Well, they just made a deal. Anyway, this is RCA, of course, is a defense contractor. So the word came down that they wanted anything about Nixon off the album. And we refused to take it off, and they booted us. But that's a common story with boomer humor, you know. I mean, that's what you never know how you're going too far. I mean, I don't think Tommy Smothers knew how he was going too far. I don't think any of us did.
Well, certainly the risk you always take if your humor really cuts deep.
Yes, sure, but in this case it didn't. You know?
Right.
I mean, I would have been much less surprised if somebody had said you've got to take that John Lennon thing off. Yeah. You know, we can't possibly. Can't possibly put that out.
You described the... I'm sorry.
Right from the start, I mean, I realized that was one of the risks that you take. I mean, when when I first came here in 1964, I was half of a comedy team. Since I weighed 240 pounds, I was considerably more than half of a comedy team. But our first job, I mean, within 24 hours, we got this job. 24 hours getting off the boat, we got the job opening for Lenny Bruce.
You're kidding.
Yes, at the, I'm not kidding, at the Café Agogo in New York. And it was just staggering because this guy was, you know, one of our sort of major idols. So we would sort of, I don't know why he needed us to open for him, actually. No one was remotely interested in our twittering British satire. But we would sit there night after night, you know, feet of this great man. And lo and behold, 3 days into the gig, in the middle of a set, the New York Police Department bounced up on stage and busted him. So, you know, our first lesson was that if you're too funny in America, you get arrested.
Boy, I see you didn't take that one to heart, though.
No.
It's interesting, you know, you describe P.J. O'Rourke, who was an editor at the Lampoon, uh-huh. as basically leading the Lampoon to its downfall. And what interests me about this is that O'Rourke is now known as a kind of Republican satirist, a conservative satirist. And I think
you don't see that as a contradiction in terms.
Well, here's what I'm going to say, that I think a lot of, you know, irreverent humor in America is always associated with liberalism or with the left.
Mm-hmm.
And here he was at the Lampoon, being pretty conservative then, too, I think. As a matter of fact, you say someone described him as a narc, because you always thought you could see his police-issue shoes showing out from his bell-bottoms.
Uh-huh.
Well, how do you think he changed the Lampoon?
Well, actually, I'd like to address the issue of satire being left-wing, because I don't think that's necessarily true at all. I think it seems to me a distinctive of this humor that it dealt with, you know, authority figures. It deals with people more powerful than you, and it doesn't really matter who's in charge, whether they're left-wing or right-wing or in the middle. You know, if the chances are that if someone's in charge, there's something ludicrous about them. And that's the job of satirists, is point that out. I think, in fact, historically, you find that, you know, this kind of satire flourished more than ever under the Kennedy administration, which I suppose is as close to left-wing as we've gotten in the last 30 years. And, you know, that sort of gives the lie to the fact that it was necessarily left-wing or liberal. The other thing, though, is that I think what O'Rourke and a lot of people like him do is, and it's something I find obnoxious and not at all funny, is that they make fun of people who are less powerful than them. In other words, they make fun of the powerless, whether that's whatever form that takes. And I just simply don't find that funny. I mean, I think it's not a worthy sort of target, and. The kind of changes that O'Rourke and other people too made in the Lampoon seem to me to both, you know, have destroyed it as a sort of reasonable expression of its generation's humor, and just to have cheapened it, you know, in a way that eventually destroyed it. I mean, I think the Lampoon, if it had, so to speak, grown up with its audience instead of becoming a teenager's magazine, could have become the New Yorker of its generation.
So very briefly, you thought that the magazine became more adolescent, catering to...
Oh, quite deliberately.
Tittering type jokes, sex
yes,
jokes.
Yes, I mean, I don't know if you can put this on the air, but we used to call it zits and tits.
Mm-hmm.
That kind of humor became the only kind of humor that the National Lampoon specialized in.
Well, Tony Hendra, I want to talk with you more about humor and about your own life, but we're going to take a short break first. My guest is Tony Hendra. He's been an editor of the National Lampoon. He produced some of their records, and he edited Not the New York Times off the Wall Street Journal. He appeared in This is Spinal Tap as the manager, and he's the author of a new book about humor called Going Too Far. We'll talk more after this short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
My guest is humorist Tony Hendra, author of the new book, Going Too Far. One of the things you write in your book is that you think some of the people who were associated with the Lampoon and with Saturday Night Live ended up becoming some of the things that they parodied, especially because of their involvement and or over-involvement with drugs.
Actually, I'm not sure that drugs were quite as big a sickness as stardom.
Oh, ego. Right.
It seemed to me that, I have really no idea what, certainly there weren't many drugs around the Lampoon. There was a lot of alcohol, but certainly wasn't much drug. Uh-huh. And I have no idea what was around, say, SNL. I think Saturday Night was probably did, on the whole, in retrospect, did the cause of boomer humor somewhat of a disservice. Partly, I think, because it was promoted as being something that it really, in effect, wasn't. I mean, it gave the appearance of being, you know, radical and revolutionary, whereas, in fact, what the material was actually very tame. And so I think people sort of got the idea that they were getting real going-too-far humor when, in fact, they weren't. They were getting parodies of Star Trek.
You know, there's a big comedy renaissance going on in America, lots of comedy clubs, more comedy shows on television. Mm-hmm. Yet you end your book Going Too Far with a chapter called Semi-Epitaph, in which you mourn the near death of boomer humor.
Yeah, well, I mean, I don't think it's dead. I certainly think it's probably in intensive care, but it's not actually
what are the symptoms?
Straight-lined yet. Well, I think one of the symptoms is that, to be quite honest, with some exceptions, which I'll get to, I don't hear many comedians today, however talented they may be, dealing with anything that I care about. You know, I mean, you have this tradition where, you know, Saul dealt with the Eisenhower administration, the military, Bruce dealt with moral and religious hypocrisy, Carlin dealt with Catholicism, Lily Tomlin deals with, you know, feminist issues, and what have we got today? Stupid pet tricks. Great, let's rip the lid off stupid pets, huh? That's, you know, that's about where we're at. That's as shocking and as dangerous as it gets. And I think pets are stupid, but I don't really have to be told. It just seems to me that most of what I see and hear today is not about things that you know, cut deep at all.
Mm-hmm. Can I ask?
Say, by the way, that there are exceptions to that. I mean, obviously, you know, most of these people are not by any means dead. I think Carlin continues to be a great comedian, mm-hmm. and I actually think that of the sort of late 80s funny people, the most interesting are the women. You know, and I include Lily and Whoopi and Elaine Boozler and Roseanne Barr amongst all those people. They seem to me to be much more sort of lively and I don't know, perhaps they have more to be angry about, but much more than their male counterparts.
Tony Hender, can I ask you a question that might be totally off the wall and ludicrous?
No.
Thanks, I'll do it. Yeah. Have you ever been a monk or a priest?
Yes.
Oh, okay. I wasn't sure if I'd made that up or not.
No. I was actually for a Benedictine monk for not very long. I was a postulant, which meant I spent about 6 months in the monastery.
It's maybe not, but it seems to me to be two really different professions here, being a monk and being a humorist. Can you mm-hmm. see any connection between the two?
Well, I think Jesus was a comedian. I do. I actually think he probably made people laugh with some of that stuff, you know? Uh-huh. You know, camel through the eye of a needle, all that. I mean, that probably passed for good stand-up humor in biblical times.
Well, did you consider yourself very funny back in the days when you were a postulant? No, seriously, some people say that, some humorists say that they never had a sense of humor till they got older or they didn't think about it.
Uh-huh.
I have heard that from...
Well, I don't know. I suppose, I might be different in this respect, but I must say I've always had a certain sort of seriousness of purpose about what I do for a living, even though it's supposed to make people laugh. And I suppose there's some connection there. And I think that's you know. But I remember certainly going to see Beyond the Fringe, you know, I went in as someone fully expecting to re-enter the monastery after I'd finished university, and I came out wanting to be a satirist. And that's all it took, you know.
How did you get out? Did you say, Father, I changed my mind, I want to be a comic?
I don't remember, actually. Maybe I should go to confession. Jeez. Please, I made fun of the church. I made fun of the Pope. Yeah.
Well, you know, I could see how there'd be more guilt that you'd have to face doing irreverent humor.
Yes, I guess so. Yeah, I guess so. I think, as somebody said in the book, the thing about being a lapsed Catholic, which unfortunately I am now, is that even though you don't believe in hell, you know you're going there.
I've seen a lot of comics who strike me as real manic depressive, manic when they're on, but really depressed when they're off. I don't know if that's something that you feel is true, but if it is for a lot of people, I wonder if you have any insights about it.
Well, that's a real depressing question, Terry. I do think it certainly seemed to me that in the various sort of collectives of which I've been part one time or another, I have never met. I mean, I've couldn't identify a group of people who are so hard on one another. It's real tough being around very funny people because they just, you know, metaphorically pull your pants down all the time. And it's, I don't know that there is any more, I mean, manic depressives in the comedy community than there are in, say, you know, the Pentagon.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us about humor and about your life. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Terry.
Tony Hendra's book on boomer humor is titled Going Too Far. It's published by Doubleday. Hendra was the editor of the National Lampoon and wrote for the Lampoon Records and for the show Lemmings. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with Joan Brumberg. Her new history of anorexia explores the cultural meaning of appetite in women's lives, from medieval ascetics to 20th century adolescence. It's titled Fasting Girls. I hope you can join us. You know, a couple of minutes ago, Tony Hendra told us he forgot the words he wrote to Deteriorata. Well, fortunately, we have the record.
Go placidly amid the noise and waste. And remember what comfort there may be in owning a piece thereof. Avoid quiet and passive persons unless you are in need of sleep. Rotate your tires. Speak glowingly of those greater than yourself, and heed well their advice, even though they be turkeys. Know what to kiss and when. Consider that two wrongs never make a right, but that three do. Wherever possible, put people on hold. Be comforted that in the face of all aridity and disillusionment, and despite the changing fortunes of time, there is always a big future in computer maintenance.
You are a fool of the universe. You have no right to be here. Whether you can hear it or not, you
remember the Pueblo. Strive at all times to bend, fold, spindle, and mutilate. Know yourself. If you need help, call the FBI. Exercise caution in your daily affairs, especially with those persons closest to you. That lemon on your left, for instance. Be assured that a walk through the ocean of most souls would scarcely get your feet wet. Fall not in love, therefore. It will stick to your face. Gracefully surrender the things of youth, birds, clean air, tuna, Taiwan, and let not the sands of time get in your lunch. Hire people with hooks. For a good time, call 606-4311. Ask for Ken. Take heart amid the deepening gloom that your dog is finally getting enough cheese. And reflect that whatever misfortune may be your lot, it could only be worse.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional funding comes from World of Travel Guidebooks, featuring the removable travel planner designed for the intelligent, inquisitive traveler. Fresh Air receives additional support from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Andrew Holleran has been called the Proust of the gay world. Now the author of Nights in Aruba and Dancer from the Dance has a new collection of essays. They contrast the abandon of the gay lifestyle in the 60s and 70s with the fear that's possessed the community since the AIDS epidemic. Coming up, Andrew Holleran reflects on how AIDS has changed gay life. Duke Ellington traveled through Asia in 1963. That trip inspired his Far East Suite. It's just been reissued, and jazz critic Kevin Whitehead has a review. Also, TV critic David Bianculli has a review of a made-for-TV movie about a private eye tracking down a woman who may or may not be a ghost. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Lori Waffenschmidt. The Republican National Convention opened today in New Orleans, with the party's chairman labeling Democratic opponents political pickpockets. Tonight, delegates bid farewell to President Reagan and look ahead to a not-so-certain future. NPR's Jim Engel reports.
The delegates will be torn tonight between a celebration of the most successful Republican president in a generation and the knowledge that there are no more Ronald Reagans around to lead the party to victory. But the president is doing everything he can to pass on his popularity to George Bush and said yesterday the nation needs George Bush's strength, vision, and true grit. The president ridiculed the Democratic theme that this election is about competence, not ideology. The president said this is not a campaign, it's a crusade for America's future. This convention is divided into two parts. The first part, a tribute to the president. The second, a focus on the party's new standard bearer, his message, and his personality. Campaign strategists didn't know how to handle the transition between the two, but finally settled on a brief encounter tomorrow morning as the president leaves New Orleans and Vice President Bush arrives. That, they hope, will symbolize the passing of the torch and confer on Bush some of the president's own stature. I'm Jim Angle in New Orleans.
The federal grand jury investigating the Pentagon procurement scandal began hearing witnesses and reviewing evidence today. A spokeswoman for U.S. Attorney Henry Hudson says the grand jury will meet behind closed doors in Alexandria, Virginia, today and tomorrow to weigh the evidence of alleged fraud and bribery in weapons contracts awarded by the Defense Department. For an indefinite period, the Israeli-occupied Gaza Strip and its 650,000 Palestinian residents remain on 24-hour curfew. Despite the restrictions, Palestinian residents defied troops and held demonstrations today, as NPR's John Hockenberry reports.
The curfew was imposed yesterday night and is only the second time the Strip has been under a round-the-clock curfew since the beginning of the Palestinian uprising 8 months ago. Arab sources in Gaza said today that scores of tires were set ablaze and barricades were erected today by Palestinians despite the curfew. The Israeli army has brought in reinforcements and, according to a number of media reports, appears to have been caught off guard by the severity of the disturbances. In touring Gaza today, Defense Minister Yitzhak Rabin said it was up to the Gazans when the curfew restrictions would be lifted.
Violence will be met by force, and it's better for the population in the territories, in the Gaza area, to realize that taking the law in their hands, drawing petrol bottles, stones, putting roadblocks, will lead nowhere.
He was touring an area where seven Israelis, including a baby, were injured in a petrol bomb attack over the weekend. I'm John Hockenberry in Jerusalem.
In an unprecedented enforcement action, the Environmental Protection Agency said today it intends to fine Ford Motor Company $230,000 for failure to provide adequate warranty coverage for emission control on its vehicles. It says the company has not fully complied with provisions of the Clean Air Act, which require auto manufacturers to guarantee all cars and light trucks issued since 1972 are designed, built, and equipped to meet federal emission standards. The agency said Ford's limited warranty plan provides for repair of emission control components, but not for other equipment which significantly affects emissions. EPA officials say they will be examining warranty policies of other auto manufacturers because an increasing number of car emission inspection programs are being put in place in cities around the country as part of federal air pollution control efforts. On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average dropped more than 33 points, closing at 2004.27. Declines led advances nearly 4-1 on light volume of 128 million shares. The average price of a share lost 41 cents. This is NPR in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. The Far East Suite, one of Duke Ellington's major works, has just been reissued after being long out of print. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead has a review.
In the 1960s, when Duke Ellington and his orchestra had become seasoned world travelers, the maestro commemorated their overseas tours with a series of orchestral suites. The best of the bunch is the Far East Suite, co-credited to Ellington and his aide Billy Strayhorn. It was recorded in 1966 and has just been reissued by RCA. Ellington suites are usually criticized for reasons that don't apply. It's said they aren't organized as suites in the narrow classical sense. Agreed, but they fit together anyway. Your ears should tell you that. It's said he wrote them to impress academics who were unimpressed, so they must be flops. In literature, that's called the intentional fallacy, judging a work by what an author intended instead of what it is. It's said that Ellington's suites are only marginally related to the music of the places he celebrated. But Ellington was no ethnomusicologist. He savored exotica not for their own sake, but for the ways they stimulated his creative juices. To make the point plain, the opening piece in the Far East Suite is called Tourist Point of View. If you know the visionary bandleader Sun Ra's music, the richly dissonant chords and Harry Carney's rock-solid baritone sax will sound oddly familiar. The tenor saxophonist is Paul Gonzalez. Tourist Point of View. The Far East Suite was actually inspired by travels all over Asia, from Iran to Japan. So Ellington favors his reeds, reed instruments playing prominent roles in numerous Islamic and Asian musics. As usual, tenorist Gonzalez and alto balladeer Johnny Hodges get specialty numbers. But the album's scene stealer is clarinetist Jimmy Hamilton, heard nowadays in the wind quartet Clarinet Summit. His central role bolsters his claim that he wrote part of the suite without credit. Jimmy Hamilton's first feature, Blue Bird of Delhi, a.k.a. Mina, is, like other pieces here, a self-contained mini-suite within the suite. The clarinet's line is based on a bird call. Thank you. Like other late Ellington sessions, this one has its low point. Blue Pepper is one of Duke's sorry attempts to get with it with a rock and roll beat. It sounds a little like the theme from Batman. Ellington's taste didn't often fail him, and pundits criticized his work at their peril. Ellington dealt in shapes and colors and extra musical themes as much as he did in melodies. Like rock and rollers about to discover the concept album, he understood there are intuitive and logical ways of uniting material that may not be obvious from looking at the sheet music. Ellington knew there's more than one way to stitch a sweep.
Kevin Whitehead is a regular contributor to Downbeat and Cadence. He reviewed the reissue of Duke Ellington's The Far East Suite on the RCA label. This is Fresh Air. ...1978 novel Dancer from the Dance. Andrew Holleran is actually a pen name the writer chose as a buffer to grant him the freedom to write boldly about private subjects. Holleran's second novel, Nights in Aruba, was about a gay man who keeps a sexual identity hidden from his parents and leads two separate lives. But in the early days of the AIDS epidemic, Holleran had the feeling novels weren't needed, that the truth was quite enough, that there was no need to make it up. His new book is a collection of essays titled Ground Zero, following how AIDS has changed gay life.
The fact is that while AIDS seems to be incredibly monotonous and repetitious and horribly unchanging, in other words, it's always the same scenario in people's lives over and over and over again, that the way we think about AIDS and the shocks we've absorbed and the way we've assimilated it into our lives has changed a great deal. So that when I found some essay that I had written in 1983, for example, it was remarkable to me because it was a little time capsule of the way I felt about AIDS in 1983, which is not the way I feel about AIDS in 1988.
Well, what are some of the ways your feelings about AIDS and your reactions to it, the way your way of dealing with it, what are some of the ways that have changed?
Okay, one of the essays I didn't put in the collection was one simply called The Fear, and it was just about the fear. And when you're writing about AIDS, when you're talking about AIDS, when you're thinking about AIDS, you can't really say, I'm suffering, because somebody else is suffering much more than you are. And yet, the thing that my reaction to AIDS was centered around really was just, of course, a personal fear. In the end, I think that so many emotional reactions to AIDS are all, in the end, fear for oneself. I think that it's always in there. Even when you are bereft over somebody else, someone you love, someone you care for, it's impossible, I think, to be a human being and not be afraid for oneself, even in those moments. And one of the things was about AIDS in those years is that you didn't know who was going to get it or what the extent was. And so everybody was walking around, I think, in this incredibly anxious state. And they didn't know when they got up one morning whether they had to, you know, get themselves ready to die or to go on living. So there's just so many stories of people who thought they had escaped, who had stopped having sex for 4 or 5 years, and then they would come down and get it. A friend of mine that happened to then went to the doctor, was told he had AIDS, and he refused to believe it. The doctor couldn't tell him that he had AIDS because he had not had sex for 3 or 4 years, and he had been doing everything conceivable to avoid it. So the thing about AIDS that is so terroristic is the time lag thing.
But fear is no longer, or is fear still the predominant reaction you have?
No, fear isn't any longer the predominant reaction in the sense that you simply go on and you can't live with that level of fear. So it's one of the things you absorb. And in the friends I have who have AIDS, I've watched the same thing. It's incredible what can be absorbed and what can be assimilated into a daily life. It's extraordinary. I mean, people will, in the end, adjust to many, many things that you can't imagine they're adjusting to initially.
In your new book, in one of your essays, you write, "We are discovering the strength and goodness of people we knew only in discotheques or as faces on Fire Island." What are some of the ways you see relationships among gay men changing now?
Oh, it's a good question. I see two things. The first thing is the old system of encountering each other, which was basically based on tricking, on promiscuity, and that kind of thing. That's pretty much absolutely gone. And it's left gay men, I think, isolated from each other in a way, because whatever you can say about promiscuity, it was a way of making contact with other human beings, and it was not, you know, it was more than sexual. So that's absolutely gone, and it leaves gay men dealing with each other in another way. And I think what's happening is that somebody said that people are becoming more considerate and tender with each other, and it's sort of that. Your friends are much more valuable to you. Not more valuable, the friends you have now you would have had anyway. It's that you've gone through a lot together and you're living in a difficult time together, and it's a kind of camaraderie and a kind of consideration and, if you will, a tenderness toward each other, I think.
You're the author of the novel Dancer from the Dance, which is, I think, considered one of the most eloquent chronicles of the gay party scene of the 70s, the discos, the baths, the parties. And I don't really know how much of an element, if any, of autobiography there is in that book. But if there is any autobiography in that, I was wondering if you left that scene because of AIDS or before it.
There was an accident in my family, and then I had to leave New York around 1981. And so I left New York for other reasons that were out of my control. And yet it was at that time that my friend Eddie got sick. He was one of the first, and all of this started. So I don't know what I would have done. I have no idea whether I'd still be in New York and what kind of existence I'd be living. I can guess because I can see what the friends of mine who have stayed in New York are now doing. And there's another factor in all of my book, I think, my books, plural, and that is growing older. And I think that after a while you simply withdraw from that kind of life, not so much because of AIDS as because you're, you know, 15 years older than you were, and going up the steps of the bar on Fire Island is not the ecstatic act that it was when you first arrived.
Did you leave New York to take care of ailing parents?
It's exactly what I did, yeah. And that's one of the things I have to write about, too. Because that happened to a lot of friends of mine. And a friend of mine once called it the avalanche. And it suddenly all happens at once. Everything seems to cave in at once on many fronts. And that's what happened to me. So that's why I left New York. It was a coincidental thing, simultaneous.
Well, I'm thinking about how difficult it must be to have parents who are old and who are ill at the same time you have friends of your age who are dying, and all the conflicting loyalties you must feel.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. You've said it. That's exactly right. It is a case of conflicting loyalties, and it's also a case of feeling that everything is just falling apart everywhere all at once, and that It's. I'm sure it's, in the end, makes you a little crazy. I have so many friends who I think are a little crazy now. They're recluses, or they're depressed in one way or another. I think this has made a lot of people crazy. I don't think anybody grasps, really, who's not in the middle of it. And this is not an accusation or a complaint. It's just a fact that if you're not experiencing something, you don't grasp anything. I don't think anybody really grasps the relentlessness, the omnipresence of it, the fact that it's endless. It just keeps going on and on, and you keep thinking it's going to subside, and it doesn't subside, and if statistics are to be believed between now and 1991, it's going to get even worse. And you think, you know, it's not possible that it could get worse. And yet it does. And after a while, you just become, I'm afraid, a little immune to it all. You just stop feeling. You can't react. Somebody just wrote a letter to me about the death of a friend, and he said, what is there to say? And that's what happens. After a certain point, there's nothing more to say. Nothing more to say. You just sit there and watch it. Watch the people die. Even though the people who like act up and the Larry Kramers are doing a tremendous service by getting the FDA to accelerate testing of drugs and stuff, all that is certainly, you can say those things. Those are well said. But on the other hand, AIDS kind of just leaves you just feeling incredibly impotent, helpless, and empty. There's just, you can grieve just only so many times, it seems.
You know, you're saying there's, after a point, nothing left to say, yet you feel a compulsion to keep writing about it. We called you to talk about it. In a way, although there's this feeling perhaps of that there's nothing left to say, there's the concurrent feeling of that you have to just keep talking about it.
That's exactly the paradox. That's exactly right. That's exactly right. Saying just what I've said is saying something, so it's a paradox, but it's absolutely true. You do keep going on, because if you didn't say anything, I think you would really go nuts. I felt bad writing about AIDS because I thought to myself, as I said on the first essay, I don't want to read anything about AIDS. I don't want to know anything more about AIDS in a way. It's just a grim, depressing thing that one tries to turn away from whenever one can, unless one has to face it. On the other hand, to write about anything else seems pointless and kind of stupid right now. So you end up writing about it and talking about it. And I think that I wrote those essays out of my own depression. And I didn't really care if anybody read them. I just was writing them because it was a way to relieve the isolation I felt.
Andrew Holleran's collection of essays, Ground Zero, is published by Morrow. Holleran spoke to us from NPR station WUFT in Gainesville, Florida. This is Fresh Air. Let's get a preview of All Things Considered. Co-host Robert Siegel is with us. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry. Welcome back.
Thanks, Robert. Well, it's round one of the Republican convention. What do you have planned?
Absolutely. Round one this evening will be devoted to Ronald Reagan. This is his night at the Republican National Convention in New Orleans. And we will be hearing from Cokie Roberts, who's covering events down there, and also will be hearing from reporter John Burnett about Reaganites at the convention. We'll be talking to a delegate from South Carolina about his vice presidential thoughts. Also this evening, a special report by NPR's Wendy Kaufman in Los Angeles about the efforts of police in L.A. to keep young kids out of gangs. The gangs seem to be doing better than the police are.
Thanks, Robert. Those stories and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. This week, a made-for-TV movie called Gotham premieres on the Showtime cable network. Television critic David Bianculli says it's more stylish than your average thriller.
It's a real familiar setting right out of a Raymond Chandler mystery. The tough guy Private Eye, the guy with a lot of scruples but very little money, sees a shadow on his frosted glass office door. In walks a strange-looking little guy acting very nervous and offering the detective a bundle of money if he'll take his case. But listen, because even though the setting and characters are familiar, the plot isn't.
I want you to find my wife. Shouldn't be hard. She's in New York. She's following me.
If she's following you, why don't you just stand still? Let her catch up to you.
I don't want to see her. I want you to see her. I want you to tell her... tell her to leave me alone.
I'm not following this, Mr. Rand. Are you and your wife divorced?
No.
Wouldn't that be a logical place to start if you really want her off your back?
No, I can't divorce my wife, Mr. Mallard.
Why not?
My wife was killed in a boating accident in 1975.
I beg your pardon?
My wife is dead.
That's Tommy Lee Jones as Detective Eddie Mallard, and Colin Bruce as his obviously disturbed client. It's the opening scene from Gotham. Gotham is written and directed by Lloyd Fonvielle, who directs better than he writes. Even so, Gotham is something special, thanks to its wonderful ghostly mood, and, most of all, thanks to its wonderful ghost. Virginia Madsen plays the client's very ex-wife, and she and Tommy Lee Jones turn this into a very electrifying and interesting showcase. Eddie's client is convinced that his dead wife is haunting him, and hires Eddie to tail him until she appears. Eddie plays along, but he's understandably skeptical, even when his client says he sees her, and orders Eddie to cross the street and find out what she wants. The alleged ghost is looking at a store display window and dressed like she just stepped out of one.
That man thinks you're his dead wife. Come back from the grave to haunt him. He asked me to come tell you to leave him alone.
That's the wildest line I've ever heard in my life.
It's not a line.
You're pretty good at it, too. What am I supposed to do now?
Well, if you could talk to me for a few minutes, it'd really help.
Right here.
Right here.
Out of the question. I've been on my feet all morning.
Can I buy you a cup of coffee?
You can buy me a drink, as long as it's someplace expensive.
It won't spoil the story to reveal that she actually is a ghost, but it would ruin the story to say anything else, so I won't. Except that it's a great concept, and that some of the images and love scenes are unforgettable, and that if the script was as good as the photography, Gotham would be a classic. It's not. But it is classy. And Virginia Madsen, who was so good in an earlier cable movie, HBO's Long Gone, is such a great, gorgeous ghost that it's spooky. And so is Gotham.
David Bianculli is television critic for the New York Post. Here's a look at tomorrow's fresh air. Tomorrow, the Japanese-American actor Mako discusses breaking down stereotypes of Asians in American movies, theater, and TV. Mako starred in Stephen Sondheim's Pacific Overtures, he stars in the new film The Wash, and is featured as an engineer in the new film Tucker. Also, rock historian Ed Ward profiles Sam Phillips, the head of Sun Records, whose stars included Elvis, Johnny Cash, and Jerry Lee Lewis. And book critic John Leonard reviews Libra, the new novel by Don DeLillo, based on the life of President Kennedy's assassin, Lee Harvey Oswald. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Production assistance from Ed Doherty and Deborah Beagle. Our engineer is Audrey Vablaitis. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. Our theme music is composed and performed by Jackie Byard. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.